Good morning. I wanted to begin this morning by thanking the Philadelphia Society for giving me this opportunity to come address you this morning. The title of my presentation is Race and the Progressive's Legacy, and we're going to get into, the previous remarks, we're going to get into, to some extent, what is history, and what implications did this have ultimately for public policy. Now, as I say, my comments this morning, I wanted to talk about the principles informing the progressives' understanding of and approach to racial matters. It might seem odd to discuss the progressives' racial policies, that is to say their support for disfranchising blacks, elaborating racial segregation, the colonial subjugation of the Filipinos, etc., in a panel focusing upon the progressives' legacy. For is this not the one part of the progressives' reform agenda that Americans have decisively put behind them? Did not the civil rights movement in the 1960s finally expunge these policies from our domestic governance? Do we not, moreover, live in a time in which the slightest hint of criticism, much less the overt subjugation of a racial minority, elicits thunderous denunciation? However all this may be, I think there are two very good reasons to consider the progressives' racial policies. First, the principles inspiring support for these policies are the very same principles which guided or inspired the progressives' reform agenda more generally. That is to say, their advocacy of minimum wages and maximum hours legislation, social insurance, social security, health insurance, public housing, agricultural planning, and the conservation movement more generally. So if we want to understand the progressives' legacy in America, which legacy is significantly entrenched in the form and substance of our governance today, we must begin by considering these principles. Second, if anything, I think it is especially instructive to consider the progressives' racial policies when seeking to clarify the character of the governance the progressives struggled so vigorously to establish in America. While the progressives believed that the decision-making of all Americans needed to be more firmly subjected to governmental control and direction, they also believed that the primitive races, those who were standing upon a particularly low rung of the developmental ladder all Americans were climbing, were especially in need of government's control and direction. The progressives' approach to the governance of these races, then, comes to side as a more extreme form of the very same mode of governance the reformers sought to impose upon Americans generally. Perhaps it would be useful at the outset to clarify whom exactly I mean when I refer to the progressives. I use this term to refer to the late 19th and early 20th century academics who were not only the theoretical exponents of what I call the positive administrative state in America, but who, through their own and their students' efforts, were among the primary architects of that state by virtue of the policy reforms that were actually carried into effect in the Progressive Era itself, the New Deal, and the Great Society. The progressives, in this sense, were the progenitors of contemporary liberals, or those who now have readopted the progressive label. But I would caution, though contemporary liberals embrace many of the same policy and institutional conclusions advanced by these earlier progressives, they are nonetheless increasingly at odds with the original metaphysical foundations of those conclusions. Contemporary liberalism, in other words, increasingly denounces the truth of the moral principles which fundamentally animated the progressives. So what were those principles? The earlier progressives repeatedly reject the fundamental principle of the founder's social compact theory of government, the idea that all men at all times and all places have a natural right to rule themselves, in favor of a new understanding of freedom inspired by early 19th century German idealism. Self-consciously following Hegel and his students, the progressives redefined individual freedom in positive terms. True or genuine freedom, from their standpoint, does not consist in the legal right to make decisions for oneself, mere negative freedom, as they termed it, but rather in the development, as Richard T. Ely puts it, in the, quote, in the most complete manner possible, all faculties, physical, mental, moral, spiritual. So what is the essence of the positive conception of freedom for progressivism? It's the most complete development of all human faculties. And they especially emphasize not only man's physical faculties, but his mental, moral, or spiritual faculties. The progressives thus commonly equate the attainment of freedom to the attainment of perfection. And that is a term they explicitly use. When redefined in this way, freedom, though inhering in all human beings as an ethical ideal, as that is unrealized potential or capacities, it essentially becomes, as John Dewey puts it, something to be achieved. In other words, when you redefine freedom as human perfection, it becomes largely a goal to be achieved, a goal to be earned, or a prize to be won. When freedom is understood in positive terms, as Ely, following the British neo-Hegelian T.H. Green, likewise emphasizes, it is the fruit of a, quote, long and arduous constructive process. This long and arduous constructive process is history, or social evolution, rightly understood. Importantly, then, while the progressive conception of social evolution entails change, this change is no mere arbitrary or directionless flux. For amid all the ebb and flow of social change, the progressives nonetheless believed it was possible to discern certain general or predominant tendencies, tendencies indicative of the progressive unfolding or development of the human potential to be free. In other words, the actualization of the human potential. Chief among these tendencies was the increasing improvement of man's rational or intellectual faculty, as well as his capacity for moral or social action. The history of morals, as John Dewey explains in a 1908 college textbook entitled Ethics, manifests a twofold movement. It reveals, on the one side, constantly increasing stress on individual intelligence and affection. It also reveals constantly growing emphasis upon the social nature of the objects and the ends to which personal preferences are to be devoted. For the progressives, then, freedom is inextricably tied to an evolutionary, or more precisely, progressive conception of history or development, in which each successive stage of development, like an acorn maturing into an oak tree, represents a fuller or more complete realization of man's moral or spiritual nature than the previous one. This is why history is progress. It has an upward trajectory. The progressives' confidence that history was thus moving towards an identifiable end, toward, that is, the fullest development or realization of the potentialities inhering in human nature, is what enabled them to rank the different races of the human family. Okay. Now, I think it's hard to overstate how profoundly the progressives' embrace of the idealistic conception of freedom in history transformed the founders' theory of government. Specifically, it entailed two important changes in the substance of government, or in other words, the character of law or public policy more generally. First, the progressive redefinition of freedom transforms the legitimate purpose and hence scope of government. This transformation has both a negative aspect and a positive aspect, a positive or constructive aspect. In terms of the negative aspect, in redefining the nature of freedom, the progressives unambiguously rejected the founders' conception of limited government. In the founders' understanding, the power of government is limited in principle by the purpose for which individuals enter into the social compact, that is to say, to secure their equal natural rights, their right to rule themselves. In denying that individuals possess such rights, the progressives likewise denied this limitation. It is not admitted that there are no limits to the action of the state, as progressive political scientist Charles Merriam concludes, but on the other hand, it is fully conceded that there are no natural rights which bar the way. The question is now one of expediency rather than of principle. In general, it is believed that the state should not do for the individual what he can do as well for himself, but each specific question must be decided on its own merits, and each action of the state justified, if at all, by the relative advantages of the proposed line of conduct. The progressives thus rejected the idea that the power of government is limited in principle to securing natural rights. In their view, all the decisions previously reserved to the individual by virtue of the founder's natural rights doctrine were now subject to public intrusion to whatever extent those in government deemed necessary. Importantly, however, the progressive transformation of the purpose of government does not merely consist in the rejection of natural rights as a limitation upon governmental power. So here's the positive aspect of this transformation. On the contrary, the progressives' embrace of the idealistic conception of freedom in history supplied new aims or principles to guide or direct the formulation of law or public policy generally. That is, from the progressive standpoint, although history or human development does not commence with the conscious pursuit of freedom in the positive sense, individuals over the course of a society's evolution had become increasingly conscious of their obligation to promote this aim in every aspect of their social relations, including government. In an advanced stage of progress or development, accordingly, the promotion of freedom in the positive sense, and hence improvement, becomes the watchword or guiding aim of public policy. In some, then, the progressives not only reject the idea that the natural rights of man limit the power of government, but they also advocated the expansion of governmental power in whatever ways and however far would be necessary to promote a wider and deeper realization of positive freedom in America and in the world more generally. The second major change in public policy necessitated by the progressive redefinition of freedom was the decisive abandonment of the idea that individuals are entitled to exercise the same or equal rights, regardless of considerations of race, class, etc. Quote, "The last few years have witnessed a great change of mind," as progressive sociologist Paul Reinsch observes in a 1905 article entitled "The Negro Race and European Civilization." He goes on to say, "The idea of the practical equality of human individuals, wherever they may be found, has been quite generally abandoned. It is clear that conditions of environment and historical forces have combined in producing certain great types of humanity, which are essentially different in their characteristics. To treat these as if they were alike, to subject them to the same methods of government, to force them into the same institutions, was a mistake of the 19th century, which has not been carried over into our own. The presumption that all men should be governed by the same methods of government, that is, by a government of limited power derived from the consent of its members, and otherwise subject to the same institutions, for example, the same economic arrangements, flows, as Reich points out, from the, quote, idea of the practical equality of human individuals wherever they may be found, end quote. But, says Reinsch, this idea has been quite generally abandoned in favor of the proposition that historical forces have produced certain great types of humanity so essentially different in their characteristics that they and the members of other races cannot be treated as if they were alike. So let us come directly to the point. How did all of this shape the progressives' approach to racial matters? The upshot of the progressive redefinition of freedom for the substance of government, in short, was that government was obliged to promote the development of all human beings, not only those at home but those abroad, on the one hand, while conditioning the degree to which they are allowed to make decisions for themselves, both in their private lives as well as on public matters, on the individual's perceived grade or stage of development. Liberty, progressive political scientist Charles Merriam emphasizes, is not a right equally enjoyed by all. It is a right dependent upon the degree of civilization reached by the given people and increases as this advances. The idea that liberty is a natural right is abandoned, and the inseparable connection between political liberty and political capacity is strongly emphasized. After an examination of the principle of nationality and the characteristic qualities of various nations or races, the conclusion is drawn that the Teutonic nations are particularly endowed with political capacity. Their mission in the world is the political civilization of mankind. Some races, in other words, had reached historical adulthood and hence could be trusted to make better decisions, whereas others, however physiologically mature, had not. In their relations, accordingly, the advanced races, the various branches of the Germanic or Teutonic peoples, including the Anglo-Saxons, must rule over the more primitive races until such time as they had psychologically matured. In foreign policy, Merriam clarifies, this meant that the United States, as a predominantly Teutonic nation, must have a colonial policy. It must, in other words, interfere in the affairs of other, more or less primitive races in order to expedite their development. These principles found no mere academic expression, but also provided the justification for the actual expansion of American power in the wake of the Spanish-American War. In a speech delivered in the Senate in 1900, for example, Senator Albert Beveridge, the future keynote speaker at the Progressive Party Convention of 1912, argued that American withdrawal from the Philippines, a Spanish colony ceded in effect to American control by the Treaty of Paris, would be, quote, to renounce our part in the mission of our race, trustee under God, of the civilization of the world. Americans, he argued, should not be squeamish about ruling the Filipinos without their consent, about forcing them, that is, to live as the United States directed. And he says, let men beware how they employ the term self-government. Self-government is a method of liberty, the highest, simplest, best, but it is acquired only after centuries of study and struggle and experiment and instruction and all the elements of the progress of man. Self-government is no base and common thing to be bestowed upon the merely audacious. It is the degree which crowns the graduate of liberty, not the name of liberty's infant class, who have not yet mastered the alphabet of freedom. Savage blood, Oriental blood, Malay blood, Spanish example, are these the elements of self-government? As the degree which crowns the graduate of liberty, self-government, meaning in this case the right to consent to one's rulers, in other words, cannot be bestowed upon liberty's infant class. That is to say, those races who, like the Filipinos, have not yet mastered the alphabet of freedom, much less anything beyond that. This was also, importantly, how President Theodore Roosevelt understood the aim of American foreign policy. In Teddy Roosevelt's view, David Burton explains, quote, human progress requires the more politically sophisticated race to rule people unable to govern themselves until they had sufficiently matured. In the case of the Philippines, then, the best interests of the Filipinos required a period of preparation for self-government under American tutelage. In the Philippine Islands, TR explained in a letter to Andrew Carnegie, we are training a people in the difficult art of self-government. We are doing this because we have acted in a spirit of genuine disinterestedness, of genuine and single-minded purpose to the benefit of the islanders. For the Filipinos, as with children generally, then, parental or colonial rule should relax in view of growing maturity. We ourselves, Teddy Roosevelt wrote in a letter to Joseph G. Cannon, must be the judges as to when they become fit and when it would be prudent to approve of independence. Now, just as the United States was obliged to take hold of the primitive peoples beyond its borders for their own good, so it was likewise obliged to do the same domestically. Among the earliest beneficiaries of this understanding were the newly enfranchised blacks in the South. The 15th Amendment had barred state legislatures from conditioning the right to vote upon race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Its effects, however, were strikingly short-lived. Beginning with a constitutional convention in Mississippi in 1890, as historian Michael McGurr notes, disfranchisement swept across the states of the old Confederacy in the next two decades. By 1908, Eileen McDonough concludes, every southern state had passed legislation establishing voting requirements such as poll taxes and literacy and registration standards that made it impossible or virtually impossible for African American men and in some cases poor whites to qualify to vote. While progressivism was not the only impetus behind such policies, it was an important one. In general, as Charles Merriam explains, the Teutonic race can never regard the exercise of political power as a right of man, but it must always be their policy to condition the exercise of political rights on the possession of political capacity, that positive development of freedom. Because the 15th Amendment was based on the understanding that the right to consent is a right of man, the progressives widely criticized it. Quote, by the cataclysm of a war in which the African race took no part, progressive economist John R. Commons complains, this race, after many thousand years of savagery and two centuries of slavery, was suddenly let loose into the liberty of citizenship and the electoral suffrage. The world never before had seen such a triumph of dogmatism and partisanship. It was dogmatism because a theory of abstract equality and inalienable rights of men took the place of education and the slow evolution of moral character. To confer rights upon men as men, rather than conditioning them upon the proven capacity to engage in self-government, as the progressives understood that, was mere dogmatism. The 15th Amendment had failed, Commons explains, because it was based on the wrong theory of the ballot. Suffrage means self-government. Self-government means intelligence, self-control, and capacity for cooperation. If these are lacking, the ballot only makes way for the boss, the corruptionist, or the oligarchy. The suffrage must be earned, not merely conferred. The legal right to vote, Commons concludes, should not be extended to blacks until such time as they, as individuals, had acquired sufficient intelligence, self-control, and the capacity for cooperation, which fitness could best be determined, he says, through an honest educational test, that is, a literacy test. Though blacks and other backward races might not yet merit the right to consent, they must nonetheless be ruled with a view to preparing them for such participation. Same thing as with the Filipinos. The great lesson already learned, says Commons, is that we must begin over again the preparation of the Negro for citizenship. This time the work will begin at the bottom by educating the Negro for the ballot instead of beginning at the top by giving him the ballot before he knows what it should do for him. The progressives thus advocated various reforms designed in important part to educate blacks, including segregation. Perhaps the best known Southern progressive reformer, says Michael McGurr, was Edgar Gardner Murphy. Murphy, who frequently addressed the subject of segregation, always stressed the dual nature of the policy. Quote, there is a distinct assumption of the Negro's inferiority, he concedes, but there is also a distinct assumption of the Negro's improvability. It is upon the basis of this double assumption that the South finds its obligation. When the races were socially segregated, blacks would not only be better protected from white violence, but would also be thrown back upon their own resources to provide for themselves. This circumstance would force them to develop economically. The very process, which may have seemed to some like a policy of oppression, Murphy concludes, has in fact resulted in a process of development. Segregation as implemented was a rather mild version of what was advocated by some progressives. I can't see that. In a 1908 article entitled A Suggestion on the Negro Problem, for example, progressive sociologist Charlotte Perkins Gilman advocates forcing certain blacks to live and work in quasi-military labor camps. The problem, she explains, is this, quote, given in the same country, race A progressed in social evolution, say, to status 10, and race B, the Negro race, progressed in social evolution, say, to status 4, given that race B in its present condition does not develop fast enough to suit race A, question, how can race A best and most quickly promote the development of race B? Her solution to this problem was to compel all blacks beneath a certain grade of citizenship, that is to say, all those who are not decent, self-reporting, and progressive, to live and work in labor camps until they had proved themselves worthy of being released and living under their own direction. In these camps, blacks, whose very presence in many ways retarded the progress of race A, she says, would be separated from whites but also forced to labor productively for themselves. In so doing, they would be taught best how best to provide for themselves, thereby developing economically, and their children would be educated in a progressive manner. This proposed organization, she feels obliged to clarify, quote, is not enslavement but enlistment. It is no dishonor, but an honorable employment from the first and the rapid means of advancement. Men, women, children, all should belong to it, all that is below the grade of efficiency which needs no care. For the children, this is the vital base of the matter, a system of education, the best we have, should guarantee the fullest development possible to each, from the carefully appointed nursery and kindergarten up to the trade school fitting the boy or girl for life, or if special capacity be shown for higher education. Okay. For the progressives, in short, the right to make decisions for oneself, both in one's private affairs as well as public affairs, was contingent upon one's perceived grade of development. Freedom, in other words, was a goal to be won, not an inalienable right the government is obliged to secure. This view, of course, holds out the prospect for the members of the primitive races that they might someday graduate into freedom. Maybe the rest of us have that hope, too. Thank you.